This is Radio Goethe on CJSF 90.1 FM, Burnaby.
Welcome to Guerrilla Radio, recorded July 9th and 10th, 2024. Well, summer was once called politics silly season, but that was before irony died and silliness gave way to the ludicrous killing joke passing for leadership today. Beyond tragically comic, President Joe Biden's disastrous first debate with Donald Trump last week makes the former president appear Napoleonic, destined to return to the throne on the Potomac in November. Not wasting a moment, Trump has promised to settle the Russia problem upon election before even inauguration day and the rest of the world's issues by Easter following or some such. It's a message Americans and the rest of the world want to hear, weary of the wars and rumors of which have smoldered and raged for the entirety of our 21st century. But there are others, powerful interests profiting immensely the immiseration and martial ruination of the people and planet who like things just the way they are. John Helmer's a journalist and author who spent decades living in and reporting from Russia. He's the principal behind the web news site Dances with Bears and has too been a professor of political science, sociology, and journalism, and served as advisor to governments at the highest levels. Among his many book titles are The Man Who Knows Too Much About Russia, The Lie That Shot Down MH17, the lately released autobiography Dunce Upon a Time, A Life of Mistakes, and Skripal in Prison, the first and perhaps only book to follow the Skripal saga from its beginnings through to the Sturgis public inquiry. His recent article at Dances with Bears is NATO's plan for permanent war in Ukraine and on the Far East front, Putin has Stalin's Hitler problem. John Helmer in the first half. And because people have better things to do this time of year, general elections are seldom held in the summertime. But these are no ordinary times. Both Britain and France have held snap elections over the last week, the results of which could have far-reaching global consequence, more so than the two former colonial titans have exerted in more than a century. Andy Worthington is an English journalist, activist, author, photo historian, filmmaker, musician, songwriter, and principal of the Four Fathers Band. His book titles include The Guantanamo Files, the stories of the 774 detainees in America's illegal prison, Stonehenge, Celebration and Subversion, and The Battle of the Beanfield. Andy's articles appear at his website, andyworthington.co.uk, where I found his latest. Despite the landslide, Labour have no vision and only won the UK general election because the Tories lost so spectacularly. Andy Worthington and Wither Albion under Starmer in the second half. But first, John Helmer and Trump's Russian route on the road to Pennsylvania Avenue. Welcome back to the program, John.
Thanks for having me, Chris. Thank you.
Well, you know, it's always my pleasure. In your article, you write, NATO's Baltic Station troops, including Canadian ones, are being told to ready for deployment into Ukraine and are being warned to, quote, expect to fight under heavy Russian artillery, missile, guided bomb, and drone strikes. John, what's the provenance of these revelations, firstly?
One source, I'm not saying there's only one, but one source is the one I rely on here, is a veteran of NATO deployments, and he's in regular contact with friends who are serving NCOs. And this is what they are saying. Now, in the piece you referred to, I have to qualify that by saying this may be a deliberate leak on the part of the US, the British, and the NATO services so that it gets picked up in the Russian media and at the Kremlin as a deterrent to expanding Russian operations in the Ukraine. So it's definitely being said, and I'm surprised that there's not more pickup of the report, because it's, if it's picked up by my sources, it's quite audible to everyone else's sources. But as you see, the official narrative is focusing now on a Ukrainian counteroffensive in the summer or autumn of this year, rather than on the engagement, direct engagement of US and NATO troops on the ground next year. But the implications are, I would say, that NATO, which is having its summit meeting shortly in the US, has no intention of decelerating or leading to peace talks, so-called peace talks, the so-called Viktor Orban fakery that we put up with last week, and he continues to flog in China this Ooh. Week.
Oh, I want to talk about that for sure. When you say that this leak may have been faked, there's a lot of head games going on right now, and that's normal enough. Is this leak, whether intentional or not, has it been picked up by the Russian press or the state there?
No, not yet. I should explain to listeners how the Russian press currently works. The Russian press is a much freer and less indoctrinated press than the New York Times, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, the mainstream U.S. and London papers. The mainstream press can be seen to be running an official narrative. Independent media are still tied to their military sources, and I rely on them to get out daily, weekly, tactical and strategical news, as well as argument. And those are what I'm calling in my reporting the Russian military bloggers, or Mil blogger for short. The best of these, Boris Rajin and Dmitry Zinchuk, Mikhail Zinchuk of Rebar, are the best of them. And they very carefully guard the criticism they make of Kremlin controls and restrictions on current military operations. And then there's the internet debating forum led by the semi-official Vzglyad internet site, which discusses security, defense, economic strategy, and so forth for the country, for the Kremlin, for the Russian general staff, and so on. When you combine all of these sources, you've got daily, I think, accurate tactical reporting, operational reporting from the battlefields, from the different directions or salients or sectors of the front in the Ukraine. You get mixed and variable and, let's say, competing versions of the meaning of Russian strategy and what the end of war game is. And you get lots of interpretation, of course, of the other side. I'm leaving out oppositionist papers and media, mainly internet media, in exile. They include Medusa and The Bell, which are published offshore, financed by the by foreign services. The onshore publication called the Moscow Times is an operation of the Dutch Foreign Ministry. It always has been a foreign entity in its entire history. That's the Moscow Times. So the Russian media are not picking up the intelligence report that I indicated, that NATO troops in units around the Russian border from Poland through the Baltic states are being told to expect to fight on the ground in the Ukraine next year. No, they're not.
Presumably, as you say, that if you're hearing it, then the state is hearing it too.
Yes.
Do you think it would have the desired effect? Do you think it would make any difference to Russia's behavior, activities, especially in the Black Sea, whether this report was true or not?
The key difference, the key argument now in Russian politics is being openly debated, if subtle. And that's the issue that several pieces I'm writing in sequence discuss. And that's the limitations which the Kremlin has placed on the general staff to fight the war along the contact line and deep into the Ukraine to the Polish border. We've seen a series of statements, and I've tried to give readers ball by ball, episode by episode, coverage of this. We've seen statements from President Putin indicating what he called in a improvised meeting with the foreign ministry some days ago, a speech in which he laid out peace terms, negotiable peace terms. They appeared to focus on Russia retaining all of the four regions of Novorossiya, that he did not mention Kharkov, in the north and Odessa in the south. He did not mention the importance of what he's called elsewhere other conditions, and they include, of course, an end to sanctions war. There can be no end to the military operations in the Ukraine without two elements, and these are called demilitarization and denazification, and these have been the objectives of the special military operation from the beginning in February 2022 and from before. These objectives imply that the Zelensky regime is now an illegal one in terms of the Ukraine constitution, and Zelensky himself and the people around him are unacceptable for the future of the Ukraine. Call that denazification. It means the removal of everybody around Zelensky who drives him towards the kind of fascist, pro-Nazi symbolism that you've seen amply displayed and amount to essentially racist doctrines against Russians and fundamentally against all Slavs, including the Poles, of course, because the Ukrainian Nazis have a long record of murdering Poles like they have of murdering Jews and Russians. Our demilitarization, the second primary strategic goal of the special military operation, and one which President Putin hasn't changed, involves the creation of a demilitarized zone. A demilitarized zone has a depth so deep as to prevent the kinds of rocket, missile, and drone attacks that are still currently escalating in the Crimea, in the four Novo Russian territories, and on the Russian traditional Russian mainland, particularly Belgorod region, and so forth. The depth of the demilitarized zone has been discussed in the past by President Putin, who calls it a sanitary zone. The more the Ukrainians rain down on Russian territory, cruise missiles like the Scalp, the Storm Shadow, Attackums, and so forth, and the more they attack Russian targets deep into Russia, the deeper that demilitarized zone has to go westward between Kiev and Lvov. These have been and continue to be the main strategic military objectives of Russia. The key argument in Russia is what to do now about stopping the attacks and demilitarizing the zone so that there can't be these kinds of attacks, and how far westward should the Russian army go and when. There's no doubt whatever that the general staff, no doubt whatever in my mind, and put more discreetly in the Russian press to which I've just referred, there's no doubt that the Russian general staff are restricted from operating offensively too far deep west. They can attack by missile as they're doing. In Kiev, you've seen the targets of massive raids this week. But these are always being described as tit for tat, for retaliation. And every military bulletin issued by the Defense Ministry, issued each day, describes these deep attacks as in retaliation for Ukrainian ones. Well, they are and they aren't. Russian military strategy to the west of Kiev cannot be retaliatory. It has to be strategically to achieve the ultimate goal of security for the Russian zone. And that can be achieved not by occupation of the Ukraine, but it can be achieved by a demilitarized zone. That could be negotiated, but presently the question of who on the Ukrainian side can be negotiated with is an open question. It's an open question on the Russian side. NATO continues and the US continues to depend on and support Zelensky.
Yeah, who has done away with any semblance of democracy there. Well, in your article, as to Putin's peace plan proposals, or too strong a word perhaps, and again, the article is NATO's plan for permanent war in Ukraine and the Far East Front Putin has Stalin's Hitler problem. You write, quote, Putin has released a sequence of statements of calculated ambiguity, if not strategic deception. So what's the point then? What game is he playing if it is strategic deception, these offers? Is he just buying time or what?
Well, you hit the right word there, Chris. Buying time. Timing is everything. That was Stalin's Hitler problem. Stalin had no doubt that Hitler had offensive intentions against Russia, but he needed to buy time against the prospect that Hitler would attack when the Soviet Union was unprepared. Ultimately, from Stalin's point of view, this is very well documented by modern, current Russian historians using all of the released archives of the time, which weren't available to the British and other creepy crawly versions of what happened around the agreement of the Ribbentrop-Molotov non-aggression pact that Stalin and Hitler agreed to because Stalin was buying time. Stalin miscalculated the timing of Hitler's invasion attack. Miscalculated. Of course, he had also seriously damaged, Stalin had seriously damaged through purging the Soviet military leadership. That catastrophic miscalculation of timing will not be repeated this time, although it's pointed out that there were miscalculations about the U.S. capability to pull off a putsch in Kiev, and that happened in February 2014. Unfortunately, the Russian leadership miscalculated the U.S. timing for that operation and counted on securing the preservation of President Yanukovych, which failed in February 2014. With all the consequences that's had. President Putin's been quite clear about what happened and how the US and NATO armies and political leaders played the role in removing Yanukovych in that putsch. What President Putin has not talked about was his sense of the timing of when the US would do it and how to stop them or how to deter them. There was another major timing misjudgment. And these are, I'm referring to sources, I'm referring to the way Russians think, the way the Russian analysts with better sources in the military than I have, the way they report these things. There was a major mistiming calculation about when the Ukraine, US, and NATO forces would move against Russia and how fragile and unstable the regime was in Kiev. The mistiming there led to the Russian paratroop special forces operation in Kiev that's known as the Battle of Hostomel or the Battle of the Antonov Airport, which followed immediately after the launch of the special operation in March of 2022. The Ukrainians were much better prepared. Zelensky regime was much more stable, and the entire political calculation of that operation was as dismal a failure as caused the catastrophic military loss of several hundred Russian forces dropped into Kiev. That's all misunderstood these days, but it's well understood by those in a position to know. So timing is everything. Now, your question raises the important point, and it's a point that obviously is in the front of everybody's minds in running the war in Moscow. When will the Ukrainian forces and the US and UK backup, the NATO backup, understand that they're close to military capitulation on the ground? And what does the meaning of President Putin's so-called peace negotiating terms, what does that mean? One interpretation is, Russian interpretation, is that President Putin has laid out the terms because he knows that, one, they'll be rejected by the US, the NATO, and the Zelensky regime, and they already have been dismissed. Second, he expects and knows we all know that the Ukrainians are planning or talking about running a counteroffensive, a new counteroffensive in late summer or autumn of this year. And that so that what will happen in Russian response will be understood and explained in retrospect as President Putin's "I told you so." In other words, he's offering peace terms now, which will be dismissed then, and he will say, "I gave you the chance again in June, July of 2024, as I gave you originally in December 2021, when I offered you a non-aggression pact and you dismissed it out of hand. I gave it to you again when we went to Istanbul and negotiated with the Ukrainians in the end of March, early April of 2022. How many more times do I have to offer you? You keep dismissing, you keep escalating, and we keep defeating you. Answer, then," and we're again talking about timing, "then Russians will say, your word is worthless. We all know that on the Russian side. We must secure that depth of Ukrainian territory to protect Russian security forever. And any attempt by the U.S. side to deploy its forces, its men on the ground," I have to point out that according to the military bulletin issued overnight by the Russian Defense Ministry, 35 foreign specialists were killed yesterday in Russian airstrikes against the HIMARS rocket complexes. By foreign specialists, that's Defense Ministry code for Americans, 35. And the day before, foreign specialists were killed in other missile attacks, 10. That probably means British or French or both. So the extent to which NATO forces are already dying on the ground in the Ukraine is well known in all the capitals concerned. If there's considerably reinforced troop deployments next year, what will happen now is the deployment of the F-16s in what the Ukrainians are advertising as a counteroffensive in the late summer or autumn. That's only weeks away. All these timing issues have to be taken into account, and then you can reinterpret what President Putin is saying. He's saying to the West, "We offered you, you dismissed it, we told you so, but the 'we told you so' will come in September, October."
Well, John, you write, and again, the article is NATO's plan for permanent war in Ukraine and the Far East Front. Putin has Stalin's Hitler problem. And I'm speaking, of course, with John Helmer. We're just coming to the half point. And so for the SFU crowd, they're going to have to reposition and go to guerrilla-radio.com to pick up the full interview. But and Andy Worthington from Britain will be on after the break. But before we get there, we've got about four or five minutes, John. You write in the article that Putin, in order to, quote, "reserve Russian freedom of action for now and to reverse the blame later on," this is part of his stalling tactic. What I wonder is, who cares? No matter what Russia does, no matter what Putin says, the Western media is going to spin it to make Russia the villain in any scenario. So why would he spend so much energy trying to make himself look like the good guy after the fact or down the road? What's he going to gain from that?
Normal politics, Chris. You're right. You're quite right. President Putin has no illusion about the brainwashing that has succeeded in the United States, in Canada, the smaller allies like Australia, New Zealand, and the more important ones in Europe. That's not the audience he's addressing with these peace terms speeches over the last few days. He's addressing, first of all good politicians do, the domestic Russian audience. If you go back a bit in the archive I've been generating recently, you'll see that Russian opinion polls show very, very strong trust in the Russian army and a very large, approximately a half, but probably more as you get older in years among Russians, the belief that the Russian army should be allowed to finish the job. And by finish the job, Russians, whom I know, who have been members of my family and who are polled, so I can read what everybody else thinks. Russians think finish the job means go to Lvov, go to the Polish border, secure Russia. Russians, not to occupy the Ukraine, but to secure Russia from the Ukraine operated as an attack platform, as Hitler once intended, and the Americans took over from Hitler in intention in 1945. So, but in saying that more than half of Russian public opinion thinks that, there's still a very sizable Russian bloc of opinion which thinks that negotiations to resolve the war and end the casualties on the Russian side is the way to go. So President Putin is addressing his domestic audience who want negotiations, and there's no doubt about that. So he's saying, look, I've offered these terms. They're the reasonable terms. They're securing us, Russia, against them, the United States, Germany, France, the Britain, and so on. And they refuse it. Every time I offer them, they refuse. So negotiations cannot be the way forward for Russian security. So he's addressing, first and foremost, the negotiations block of Russian public opinion. The second block of public opinion is international. We all agree, Canadian media, American media don't care what people think in China, India, and in the serious rest of the world. But Russia cares. Chinese care, Indians care, Africans care. These are the majority of people in the world, the so-called global South. So President Putin is saying to them, because the South African President Ramaphosa, Cyril Ramaphosa, led a peace mission of African states on these issues, and because President Modi of India is in Russia at the moment discussing these terms, and because China has had its peace proposal on the table, President Putin's negotiating terms are addressed to the global South.
Okay, well, let's get into that in the second half. And as I said earlier, for you at SFU, you're going to have to go to guerrilla-radio to get the whole conversation, or go to John's website at Dances with Bears. Thanks a lot, John. The second half for SFU and the rest is going to be with Andy Worthington. We're going to talk about the recent election and other things, too. Thanks, John.
Thank you very much, Chris.
Their message always to everybody through all their advertising, all their PR, everything is, we are your friends. And it's like, no, you are not our friends. Friends are not people. Bottom line is how much profit they can make out of you. It is completely different.
Guerrilla Radio, knowing who our real friends are since 1999.
We're running out of time to put out a fire.
Well, welcome back to Guerrilla Radio. Well, because people have better things to do this time of year, general elections are seldom held in the summertime, but these are no ordinary times. Both Britain and France have held snap elections over the last week, the results of which could have far-reaching global consequence, more so than the two former colonial titans have exerted in more than a century. Andy Worthington is an English journalist, activist, author, photo historian, filmmaker, musician, songwriter, and principal of the Four Fathers Band. His book titles include The Guantanamo Files, the stories of the 774 detainees in America's illegal prison, Stonehenge, Celebration and Subversion, and The Battle of the Beanfield. Andy's articles appear at his website, andyworthington.co.uk, where I found his recent article, Despite the Landslide, Labour have no vision and only won the UK general election because the Tories lost so spectacularly. Welcome back to the program, Andy.
Always a pleasure, Chris.
Well, now, Andy, it's a 4th of July, New Labour landslide victory. So then why does it feel so miserable on July the 10th?
Well, because for a number of reasons. So the main reason is that, you know, as I said in that article, Labour very carefully avoided sending out any truly hopeful, positive messages that they had a vision for how to revive the UK after 14 dreadful years of Tory rule. What I did notice, and I think many people in Britain would agree, is that after this landslide victory, which they secured without any increase in the number of votes from the last time that